Okay, we'll take your phone calls now this hour with David Kirkpatrick as we talk about the Facebook effect. That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, where David Kirkpatrick, and we're talking about Facebook, of course. When Facebook started coming out, David, and you were with Fortune magazine, how did you become so aware of it?
Well, you know, the way it works is when you work for a magazine like Fortune covering companies, you know, covering an industry, you're constantly kind of barraged with PR people trying to get you to meet with this or that executive. And in the summer of 2006, I got a call from a PR person who was an in-house person at Facebook saying, you know, you want to meet with Mark Zuckerberg. And I was one of pretty much everyone in the industry, in the press of covering tech, who kind of, you know, we were noticing that there was this interesting little thing happening on colleges called Facebook, but we hadn't really honed in on it, and nobody was taking it that seriously because it seemed like it was just for students. And, you know, so I knew it was growing really fast, so I decided I would, yeah, definitely be interested in seeing Zuckerberg. So I had lunch with him in early September 2006. And I describe all this in the book and how he walked into this restaurant in Midtown Manhattan, and he was so young. I mean, I was really, really shocked to see the way he looked. I mean, I just couldn't believe somebody.
You'd be about 22 then, right?
He was at that time, younger than, let's see, yeah, 22, right. He was 22. And honestly, I just couldn't believe how young he looked and how young he seemed. And then he opened his mouth, and what he said and his articulateness was well beyond his years. And I really suddenly realized in talking to him that this was someone with very unusual scope of vision, who was extraordinarily committed to growing something that really had a lot of meaning. And, you know, he really impressed me dramatically at that first meeting. And I went back and I wrote a piece, a column called Why Facebook Matters. And it was kind of my putting a stake in the ground that this company was really more than most people had realized. And it was very early in my business and business technology journalism for someone to write something like that. And that kind of got me on his good side, to be honest, that he kind of thought, oh, Kirkpatrick gets it. And that is sort of began the chain of events that led him to agree to cooperate with the book. But it also led me to start paying much closer attention. But I'll tell you, just a funny story. After that, even though I wrote that piece, I was busy doing other stories. I was doing some big Microsoft story. And Zuckerberg started calling me and emailing me and saying, you know, you really ought to come out and check out something we're working on. And I was like, yeah, well, I don't have time, you know. And then in like, I don't know, April of 2007, I was out in California anyway, and I said, I'll call Zuckerberg and see if he wants to get together for dinner or something. And I called him up, and he said, oh, okay. So we went to dinner that night, and it turned out they were about to do this incredible thing of turn Facebook into a platform for applications created by other companies, which has really subsequently defined a lot of what Facebook is all about. Facebook's platform is the biggest thing that it's doing. It's really trying to extend itself to be a place where anybody can sort of tap into the services of Facebook. But they launched that in May 2007, and I wrote a big piece about it at the time. From the inside, as a result of Zuckerberg telling me about it at this dinner. And that was sort of when I started to realize I really needed to pay closer attention. And after that, I did. And then about 6 months later, I started talking about writing a book. And then in January of 2008, Zuckerberg told me he'd cooperate, and the rest is the book.
Most people missed the mark with Facebook, with Twitter, with probably even YouTube. I bet they just don't understand it.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people use these things without understanding. I mean, all of us use YouTube, for example. I mean, and yet it's easy to use it and take it for granted and not realize what an extraordinary thing it is that Google, which now owns YouTube, makes available this system that lets literally anyone on the planet who has an internet connection get access to all this video on all these topics. I mean, I don't know. I was just aware of it the other day when I was on vacation in the Adirondacks, and I was just poking around. I happened to have an internet connection there, and I found this YouTube video of this great John Coltrane jazz performance from the 50s, you know, and I put it on Facebook as on my page, you know, just as I sometimes do. But I was thinking, you know, I could have easily been in, you know, Cambodia or upper, you know, in Chad or Uruguay. And I have, if I could be a 12-year-old kid and I could be on YouTube anywhere in the world and I could find that same video. And I tell you, it's an extraordinary thing that's happening on the internet. And I don't think most people are realizing just how different it is from the past. I mean, the older we are, I think the more we realize. We remember when there were no phone answering machines. I mean, I was just struck, George, by all the different ways your listeners can get in touch with you. You use the technology very aggressively, clearly. You know, you've got your Skype address and everything. These things are just like opening up possibilities right and left, and it's very hard to keep track of it. I'm a professional journalist covering technology, and even I can't even believe what's going on half the time.
No, I agree. And, you know, like you, David, I'm a baby boomer, and I learned the hard way. I mean, I was a dinosaur. And, you know, I started in this business of broadcasting when I was 19 years old.
Wow, 19, and, just like Mark Zuckerberg.
I mean, and I've worked with some of the best, thank God. And I've watched them, I've learned from them, but I've been through almost every facet. And when I came into this new technological age, which is moving very fast, as you know, I couldn't understand it. I looked at it and went, this is incredible. I used to do my talk shows years ago. I'd come in with newspapers. I'd get the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and a few magazines, Newsweek and things like that. And I'd start clipping them.
Yeah.
And I'd look for story ideas and things like that. We had the Associated Press and United Press International with, at that time, their teletype machines. And, you know, I'd go into the booth, I'd go into my studio, and I'd have all these newspapers all over the place, and I'd start doing my thing. Well, then once the internet started, it became easy for me to just sit at my computer and go through all those same sources and more that I used to have to spend hours clipping, and yeah. I was able to just get it like that really fast. And then I kind of like stayed in that arena for a while. And then I saw all this other stuff happening, and I said, you know what, we need to stay current with this. And thank God my staff is so digital savvy. And, you know, they kept saying, hey, George, do this. You know, if it wasn't for them, I'd still have a cell phone with the antenna that you pull out, you know?
No, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. It was on my iPhone that I saw that statistic at the break about 45% of British internet use is just Facebook alone. I mean, I was just grazing through some emails and I got a link and I clicked on it. And this is on my little handheld while I'm just sitting here talking to you on the phone, you know?
It's remarkable. Let's take some calls. We'll pick it up by going to Reno, Nevada. Spike is there on Coast to Coast. Hey, Spike, welcome to the show.
Hello. I have a little story about Facebook. Yeah, I'm in a bike club and we have like little get-togethers and parties out in the middle of nowhere, and had police showing up, feds and sheriff and every all the time, you know. And we started thinking about it. We're like, it's probably we were posting it on Facebook all the time, so we stopped posting it on there, and we went out and partying it up, and nobody showed up.
They were monitoring you.
Yeah, yeah. Then we thought maybe it was just a, you know, a fluke, so. We put on there that we were going to this bar. We know the bartender there. And we just said, yeah, we're going to go over. And we had this big shindig, and it was all fake. And they came down there, and they're watching and taking pictures.
Amazing.
That is a great story. That is, there you go, what I was saying before. The police are all over this thing.
Yeah. They were. Now, who do they assign at some police department to monitor this?
I don't know. I really think if you ask any detective in any police force, probably in most of the planet, are they using Facebook? They're going to tell you yes. I mean, I'm sure many police departments have specialists, but, you know, this is such a universal tool, and it applies in almost, think of it, if 130 million Americans are on Facebook and there's a crime and somebody's a suspect, the first thing that detective's going to do is try to go and look at the Facebook profile of the person who's the suspect. And, you know, Facebook, if the company gets a subpoena, they will turn over everything, including, you know, the records of what the person posted and who their friends are, no matter what their privacy controls are. If there's a subpoena, but you know, they won't just do it because the policeman calls them up and says, hey, you know, let us see it. But like I said at the beginning, the privacy controls are not used very effectively by a lot of users of Facebook, particularly, you know, I mean, a really professional criminal is going to be smart enough to be not putting too much on Facebook without a lot of privacy controls. But, you know, young kids who are just sort of reckless and then might go out and steal something or, you know, drag race or who knows what, you know, minor crime, you know, they're probably totally wide open on Facebook because they probably haven't used any of the privacy controls. That would be typical. So once when a cop wants to find out about them, they can.
What do you think happened to the guy at News Corp who recommended that they buy MySpace?
Well, you know, I think that's a good question. I'm not sure that News Corp regrets buying MySpace at this point, although Murdoch, who is the CEO of News Corp, has said even is, you know, only about a year after he bought MySpace, he started musing in public that maybe he'd bought the wrong system, wrong service, and he should have tried to buy Facebook. Of course, Zuckerberg would never have sold to him. But, you know, News Corp has made a lot of money on MySpace. I think probably, you know, in retrospect, it seemed like they got a good deal at the time because shortly thereafter there were people paying a lot more for similar services. But I think maybe it was not the smartest move. I don't think the person – I think I know the person who recommended it, and he's still working there.
I mean, if you were working at MySpace now, would you say – you know, I'm in a dying little industry or company.
Well, I mean, what I think they're doing in MySpace is very smart. They are trying to convert it over to becoming more of a place to discover media, whether it's music or movies or television stuff. And they're doing a pretty good job of it. As you mentioned, you know, there's no self-respecting rock band that doesn't have a MySpace profile. And if you want to hear the cutting-edge music by some band that doesn't yet have a record, the place you're most likely to go and find it is on MySpace. So that's definitely a good market position to have. It's just not nearly as big as, you know, the social network that's replacing email, you know.
Yeah, that's true. Let's go to Los Angeles. It's Bob's turn on Coast to Coast. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Hey, wonderful show today. Incredible topic. I've worked for many years dealing with fraud. I'm sure you guys probably know who I am. I don't know. I told them before. But it's interesting. I deal with a lot of databases and stuff, IRB tracers and stuff like that. We use to track down people. You know, they have billions of searches within these databases. And number one, you have to think for a minute about this. You could look back and research this, that a good percentage of money what has been invested into Facebook was the Central Intelligence Agency used for domestic terrorism, domestic investigating, you know, domestic spying during the Bush administration. It's a fantastic tool, you know, for your friends and family and stuff, but yet it could be used as double-sided sword here in order to create problems and tracking people down commit crimes against us, as we heard earlier on this show. And now think about this for one second. Now, if there was a such thing as Facebook in Nazi Germany, there wouldn't be a thing called Jews anymore because they would have all been tracked down globally and exterminated. So this tool could be used, you know, by a dark source, dark force in order to create havoc globally. And it's great for intelligence networks. I mean, hell, we probably know through Facebook where Osama bin Laden is. Probably right now. He's one of his drug dealers or something, you know, inside of it. But it could be used for, you know, harm too. As you know, commonly almost all police departments in the United States have direct access without a written warrant. They could actually ping your phone. That means GPS ping, mm-hmm. Find out where you are within 12 inches. Anytime they go in there, one cop in L.A. was just arrested, placed under arrest for abusing GPS and lost his job and now is spending 6 months in jail because he thought his girlfriend was cheating on him and he used GPS tracking to track him. So a cop did this. So if a cop could do this, you know, imagine on Facebook, police officers or whatever, you know, they could a lot of privacy infringements could be, you know, inflicted on the general public through this. So you'd be real careful. Like for me, I'm involved in certain things where I show my friends and they sort of laugh because I created I use Facebook as a disinformation channel for myself. I put a bunch of fake information about me. So it's basically a popcorn trail that leads from here to the moon and back. And it would take someone 20 years going through all this disinformation I placed on there. It's just a hobby of mine. And just to see how scrambled and how I could teach people how to protect their privacy. And privacy in this country is really a serious issue now.
It's huge. David, will this privacy issue affect companies like Facebook eventually?
Oh, totally. I mean, basically, I think there's certain things the caller said I couldn't agree more with. Some things I don't agree with. But, you know, this issue of privacy being a really critical issue is undeniable. I mean, Facebook just this week launched something called Facebook Places, which is a way to tell your Facebook friends literally where you are right now. And the first thing that happened, as happens every time Facebook basically announces anything these days, is that privacy advocates started saying it was poorly implemented from a privacy point of view, and they had to start defending themselves against a lot of criticism. In this case, in fact, they had tried very hard to forestall that by working with a lot of privacy advocates, and in fact, that has died down a little bit already. And although I do think that Facebook Places, misused by Facebook members, can be a very serious privacy problem, but it's really, again, it's sort of in the hands of the user. It's their responsibility to think through what they're doing and not expose themselves unreasonably. But I really also do agree with the caller that in general, privacy is a serious problem in the United States and in the world, and it goes way beyond Facebook. I mean, if you look at what the credit rating agencies have, and as he pointed out, the police can just, if they feel like it, and this cop may have been arrested, but you know there's probably other cops that don't get caught, just like, for the fun of it, observe their friends where they're traveling or what they're saying, you know. And this is not great, but we live in a digital world where all of this information is, intrinsically observable because it's in digital form and we're all connected through this one internet network. Yeah, but could I just say one thing I really do disagree with him about? Thing he said about Nazi Germany, I think, is really a debatable point. Because, like, for example, today, there are a lot of groups on Facebook praising Al-Qaeda. Are they huge in places like the United Arab Emirates or Saudi Arabia or Lebanon, where Facebook is a very big phenomenon in all those countries? No, they're not. Those groups are not the predominant things that are happening over there. So, you know, I think, you know, what happens on Facebook, again, is that you have all of humanity there. So your opinion of what is going to happen or would have happened on Facebook depends on what you think about humanity. You know, it may be that if something like Facebook had existed during the period when the Nazis were coming to power in Germany, there would have been enough ability of other ordinary citizens to speak out against it, and maybe it wouldn't have grown so rapidly. Maybe it would have grown even smaller than it turned out to grow.
It could have had a reverse effect.
Yeah, I think it's impossible to know, but I think it's... people will be people, and if you believe that people fundamentally have positive impulses and want the world to be a better place, then you're probably going to believe that the net effect of Facebook is going to be to make the world better. If you basically believe that people are evil and sketchy and are out to get us all and we're going down, then Facebook's going to be the place that's going to happen. It's all a matter of, you know, your point of view, in my opinion.
All right, well, stay with us. Even our friends at ZZ Top, Billy Gibbons and company, they're on MySpace, for example. We'll be back in a moment. We'll take your final questions on Coast to Coast AM. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, first of all, science advisor Richard C. Hoagland will come on in our news segment, reacting to NASA's announcement, which will take place in just a few hours, on what Kepler might have discovered looking at a planetary system. And then investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us. And among her stories that she's been covering, why is NASA opposed to Steven Spielberg's film, Close Encounters of the Third Kind? So that'll be a classic Coast to Coast show. And when we come back with David Kirkpatrick, author of The Facebook Effect, we'll take final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We have a text message in from Carol from Idaho for you, David. And she wants to say know about people... go on vacation, they post it on Facebook and Twitter that they've been robbed. Is this true or is this a myth?
Well, you mean if they say it certainly makes sense to me. It has happened plenty of times that people have posted information on Facebook about their whereabouts and somebody has then gone and robbed their house or done something else nasty to them. I mean, But I'll tell you one of the reasons I think that happens. It is, by the way, an issue of concern with this new Facebook Places thing. And even I was wondering about it. You know, I was on the road the last few days, as I said, and I was trying out Facebook Places and checking in at various places in Ohio. And I was thinking, wow, somebody might figure out I wasn't home. But I'm home back again now. But the reason that people have this problem in part is that there is a fundamental error that most members of Facebook, even including me and possibly you, typically make, which is we accept too many friends that aren't really our friends. And what is not
you take really, everybody who comes in the door, right?
Yeah, but what most people don't think about enough is that when you make someone your friend on Facebook, you are essentially giving them license to see all your information. And unless you are a very aggressive user of Facebook's privacy controls, which, as I said earlier, are way too hard to use and Facebook really needs to improve, and even if you're an aggressive user, you probably can't do it perfectly well. You really shouldn't be friends with people who you don't really know. And if you are friends with people you don't really know, and then you go on vacation and say, I'm on vacation in the Bahamas with my whole family, you know, one of those people you don't really know may turn out to be not as trustworthy as you thought, you know, and maybe they'll come by your house and take advantage of the fact you're in the Bahamas.
Good point. All right, back to the phones. We'll go to Clayton, Missouri. David's with us on Coast to Coast. Hey, David, how are you?
George, I'm irritated with you.
Why?
You disrupt my sleeping patterns there.
That's a good thing.
Oh, George. Anyway, I'm 38, and I have a lot of friends my age, and we just guys my age, and we find Facebook to be kind of a silly thing. And I think that the popularity of Facebook, the exponential growth of it, is more of a reflection of the isolation that most people feel in the world that we live in today. I mean, when I grew up, my mom always taught me, look, you're probably lucky in your life if you have two or three good friends. And you value those relationships. But you see people on Facebook where they have 800, 1,000 friends like you were talking about. And these people, to me, it's almost abhorrent to me to try to list that many, put that many friends if I was going to have a Facebook account, because that's not what I define a friend as being. So to put that on there seems ridiculous to me if you're going to add all these people, they're not really friends. So I don't know. Maybe they should come up with a different name for that. But I even just in today's society, maybe I'm living in the past or something, but I see people walking down the street and they're on these phones. And to me, there's no past. There's no future. There's the here and now. And if you live in this world of this handheld portable device where you're trying to connect with other people, it takes you out of the here and now, out of the present, out of experiencing life. And I think that can be a serious negative effect on today's society, and I only see it getting worse.
Well, you know, he's got a good point here, David, too, because people are turning to these social networks, turning to Facebook to try to escape, I think.
Well, I mean, it's just another one of these areas where everyone has their own opinion. I don't happen to agree in general with that point of view, although I think it does apply to some people. I don't think that is the way best to understand the overall phenomenon of Facebook, because I think actually most users are using it for what they consider to be a far more effective and positive set of purposes than what that would suggest. I mean, the reality is, a lot of people in modern society are isolated and do need tools to better communicate with other people, whether they live in a remote place, whether they're traveling all the time, whether they're sick and home. You know, it's, I think, kind of a wonderful thing that somebody, you know, even somebody who's like really, really sick and can't get out of bed can communicate with their friends in a very efficient manner using some of these new tools, especially Facebook. You know, and whether or not, you know, what Facebook represents is people just sort of idly frittering away their time and overstimulating themselves, I mean, of course, that's got to be true for a lot of people. Is that the way to think about this whole phenomenon? No. It's just one window into a massive social and cultural phenomenon that involves 500 million people and as a result includes all kinds of behavior, all kinds of uses, positive, negative, boring, intelligent, stupid. You know, it's like that's just there's a tremendous tendency to oversimplify what Facebook represents. Which is another reason why I wrote the book, because I think, you know, one of the things that I think is really useful is to understand the history of where this thing comes from, because it'll help figure out where it's going to go. And I don't really know where it's going to go any better than anybody else. I do know the history better than most people, and I wrote it down, and you can read it. But, you know, but I really don't believe it was designed to help people fritter their time away. But I will, here's a funny thing. You know, I keep talking about my iPhone that I'm holding during your breaks. Mm-hmm. Well, during the last break, I was reading an article in tomorrow's New York Times by part of this great series that Matt Richtel there has been writing about the impact of digital devices on our minds. And just look at the headline right here. It's really relevant. It's the headline is, wait a minute. Digital devices deprive brain of needed downtime. This is a headline in tomorrow's New York Times. So, you know, the fact is there is evidence that we're misusing a lot of these devices. It's not just Facebook. It is the cell phone. It is, but you know, is it I know Matt Richtel. I've talked to him about this series he's writing, and I'm not sure that even that, well researched as it is, it's not. There's no yes or no on any of these things. You know, yes, we are overstimulated by Facebook and cell phones, but also yes, we have the ability to find someone who's lost on a mountain because they have a cell phone, or we want to have a cell phone because now if we break down on the side of the road, we can get help faster, or we want to be able to, you know, there's a million positives, there's a million negatives, and I think what's really happening is that, again, going back to this pace of change issue, which you and I discussed earlier, George, is that, you know, all these things are happening so fast that yes. None of us really know how to use them. And by the time we figure out how to use one thing, it's already been replaced by something else. And, you know, that is seen by some people as intrinsically a negative, the pace of change. And maybe, oh, wouldn't it be great if the world slowed down and we were all living back in the 19th century without any phones at all? You know, milking the cow in order to get our milk. I don't know. That's not the world I want to live in. But we've all got to sort of draw our own line as to how much of this stuff we want to immerse ourselves in. And I mean, I think the caller is totally legitimate for his own life to not use Facebook very much or view it as something of a frivolous activity. For me personally, I actually find it quite valuable to understand more about my friends. I try not to get too overwhelmingly caught up in it. But it's tough.
When I was in Los Angeles at a restaurant, I looked over, there was a table of four people, two couples, and during the entire dinner, not one of them talked to the other person at the table.
They were all on their phone.
They were all texting away.
I've seen that myself. Look, let's face it, that's pathetic. But that's just one table. Maybe the other table, you know, they just got word from their kid that they won a prize at school, and they were telling the whole table about it, and they wouldn't have had the information if they didn't have a cell phone. You know, it's.
Yeah, but how often does that happen? You know,
your kid doesn't get enough prizes. That's what it is. But I think good things happen that we find out about by technology every day, and all of us are experiencing that every single day. I mean, I think it's we. You know, we have to just use everything in moderation. That's sort of the secret of life. But there's one observation I want to make, too. You know, this issue of isolation is a very interesting one. You know, if you think, and also it goes to this question of privacy. I think it's really, this is the kind of thing that led me to write the book, is this kind of thought. You know, 100 years ago, we all lived in small towns, pretty much. And still, most of the planet still lives in villages and small towns, right? In a small town, you know everybody's business. There is no privacy. You know, most people in the world live in favelas or shanty towns or huts where they can hear through the walls what's happening in the next hut, right?
Well, David, I remember the days when my parents would make phone calls. They'd have to wait for the neighbor to get off.
There you go.
In order for them to make a call. I mean, right. You could pick it up and hear your neighbor talking.
Right. Well, but my point is that, you know, whereas most of the world, most of our history has been in small towns and villages, an interesting thing happened just in the last year. The majority of humanity just in the last year began living in cities for the first time ever. So we're now all in cities where we don't have that sort of natural window into the lives of all the people around us, which caused everybody to have no privacy. Now, in effect, we have privacy, but we also have isolation. And I think it's quite interesting to observe that Facebook has emerged and has been embraced by 500 million people and growing more than a million new users a day at exactly the same time that the majority of mankind is living in cities. Because it may be that some degree of that intimacy and constant interaction of the small town is really what people want, and maybe Facebook is sort of electronically recreating that for them.
Absolutely. It's Williamsburg, Kentucky we go. It's Robert's turn on Coast to Coast. Hey, Robert, go ahead. Thanks for calling.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good.
I had a question. I was just wondering if Facebook was going to eventually overrun MySpace and MySpace would be done with. And another thing I just wanted to point out, it may sound silly, but I mean, we've came so far with technology so fast. I mean, like you guys said, I mean, once one thing's out, you know, something comes out to replace it in no time. And I was just wondering what the guests envision in like 25 years of what, whoa. I mean, what's
that's
going to be?
5 years, maybe.
Yeah, 5 years is as far out as I could even begin to guess. I mean, 25 years, man, we're going to be telepathically, you know, we're going to be, it's like going to be Star Trek where we're beaming ourselves up, Scotty. I mean, honestly, if you look at the pace of change, you could easily imagine that kind of stuff. But I will say one thing. I mean, I think it's a really great question. And I think, but first on the MySpace question, it's basically already happened. As we, you know, Facebook has basically trounced MySpace, and I have a whole history chapter in the book about the history of social networking. And you know, the reality is, MySpace is now mostly a music site, as we've discussed. But one of the things that's happening right now on the internet that I think points to the future is this video communication. If you look at the new iPhone 4, for example, with this FaceTime application, which allows you to have a real-time video call from any iPhone 4 to any other iPhone 4. Right now you have to be in a Wi-Fi zone, but pretty soon you'll be able to do that from any phone over the normal networks, would be my prediction. It probably won't be too far in the future.
Dick Tracy, here we go.
Yeah, right? So video conferencing is just going to become part of the way we live. I just saw today also, while I was looking at my iPhone, that Google has just announced they're going to turn Gmail into a phone service to compete with Skype. So basically, this real-time communication, both in audio and video, is just taking over. And my own personal belief is the one thing that's going to happen is we're probably all going to have video cameras on us basically all the time. They'll be used, it'll basically be an auxiliary memory for ourselves. And I've believed this for some time, and it's becoming increasingly feasible to do it because storage is so inexpensive that you could just carry a camera. You could just have a little $20 camera on your lapel, store your whole life in video. You could basically do it now, probably for an affordable price.
The Truman Show.
And then you don't even need memory anymore, George. Then you can figure out. Then we'll figure out ways to search video. And I'm not joking. This is all going to happen. And you're going to say, "What was that guy I met, you know, in Kentucky, you know, 25 years ago on that street corner?" And you'll just like search in your video archive, and you'll have the answer.
And there he is. Yeah. I'll tell you what, though. Here's my prediction. We're going to get hit with an X flare from the sun, and it's going to cook all these satellites, David. And everybody's going to be out.
Well, you know, that's really an interesting thing, that this whole idea of an electromagnetic pulse. You know, the U.S. and other countries have nuclear weapons that are not, don't create an explosion. They just create an electromagnetic pulse. These weapons exist. And if those were used and they shoot them off in the upper atmosphere and then they knock out everything electrical, right? What if that happened now in the world we're living in, when we're also incredibly dependent, not only on Facebook, but on Google, on, you know, our web, everything would be knocked out. The cell phones would be knocked out. The internet would be knocked out. You know, we would go back.
ATMs would be knocked out. I went by a drugstore months ago, and their computers went out. They tried to do things manually. They ended up shutting the store down for the whole day.
Exactly right.
They couldn't do it.
I mean,
well, you go up.
We would be in the Stone Age in 5 minutes.
Go up to a fast food restaurant, which I don't go to anymore, and give somebody $10 for whatever you ordered And I defy you to find someone who could calculate how much to give you back out of their head. Kids don't do that anymore. Everything's computers.
Yeah.
You know, calculators, everything.
I mean, Google is fantastic and Wikipedia are fantastic. I think we all have to admit we use these things all the time. We probably couldn't live without them. But, you know, in some ways we probably are losing the ability to remember certain things because we literally don't need to remember stuff as much. You know, I hope we're replacing that with some other capacities that maybe are making life better. I still believe personally that life is continuing to get better for pretty much all of us. And technology is a huge reason for that. In fact,
I agree. But we could live without it.
Well, we could live without it, but we would be back in the, you know, agrarian past. And, you know, we'd have to learn to be farmers again real fast.
Don't you want to just watch Leave It to Beaver again?
Well, that's not going far enough back. But, yeah, I loved Leave It to Beaver. That's our generation, right?
We can do that. We're not going to have time for any more calls, but I do want you to give out your website, David.
Yeah. I don't have a website. I have a page on Facebook. It's the Facebook Effect page on Facebook, and I have about 6,000 followers or fans or likers or whatever the current terminology on Facebook, because they change that all the time. And that's the best place to follow what's happening with my book. And like I said, you know, you can get it on Amazon and all kinds of other places. Any bookstore has it pretty much. And it's available in audiobook. And I really have enjoyed the talk, George. It's great to have such a chance to talk at such length about these things, because these are complicated subjects. And this is why I think it's worth writing a whole book about. But, you know, your audience is a real great audience be talking to. So thanks.
I'm gonna put you in our expert file, by the way. Whenever there's any breaking news like this, we're gonna call you and get you on real fast. Thank you, David. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Lottasour, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.